You are listening to The Tie.
I am Joe McDonald.
Sean Carter.
Brentley Romine.
DJ Pihowski.
Wright Thompson, and you're listening to The Tie Podcast.
The Tie.
The Tie Podcast.
The Tie.
Thank you for listening to The Tie.
Thank you for listening to The Tie.
I'm Dottie Pepper, and thank you for listening to The Tie.
I'd just be sitting on the ground between every shot. It was still great, right? If you love golf, you deal with it, but it's less than ideal. The better players at every level have an outsized impact on the sport. And I think it's super important for things to be addressed from the top down.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Tie Podcast. My name's Henry Shemp. Today I'm joined, I believe for the third time, by Andy Johnson from The Fried Egg. Andy is like my moral compass in the game of golf. I think he and I think similarly in that we're pragmatic dreamers, I would put it. We like to, you know, think about how to improve the game and develop things, but keep it within the confines of what's realistic and what's actually going to happen. So on that note, today we're talking about pace of play and some of the issues and things that we've seen and some of the conversations going on around the PGA Tour, but then more importantly, how that extrapolates into the game, into the public realm, as well as just recreational golf and some of what we see on tour and what could be improved, and then how that could potentially improve our experiences at just the recreational level. So always fun to talk with Andy. Hope you all enjoy listening to this episode. Without further delay, let's get straight to it. Please welcome Mr. Andy Johnson to the Tie Podcast. Good morning, good afternoon. Welcome back to the Tie Podcast. My name is Henry Shemp. I'm joined once again by Andy Johnson. Always fun to be on the ones and twos. Andy, what's going on today?
Not much, man. Just I'm playing golf today. So it's a, you know, not rare. I guess I play a lot of golf when I travel, but I'm playing golf at home, which is a very rare home game for me. I got invited to a member guest and playing a little competition. It's albeit not much competition, you know, in the sense of the grand scheme of like what a competitive event is. But I'm gonna feel like I need to play well for my partner. He's requested that I play modern clubs too. So had to go find some modern clubs to get to play.
It's like using real butter or something like that. You know, you get used to something fake and you're like, this is not too bad. And then you do the real thing and it's pretty darn nice. So that might be a welcome surprise.
Yeah. How have you been?
Good. I actually played a little golf this morning. Like, I mean, apropos to our conversation today about pace of play, live in Austin, Texas, great place. But as you know, the golf scene and public golf scene is pretty tough. And brutal. If you don't get out there before like 7:30, the odds of getting any golf energy. In fact, I got out there 6:40. I think sunrise was like 6:49. So I actually beat the sunrise. There were people on the tee, had to like go over to the third hole. I only had an hour to play and got seven holes in. So I might just need to start playing at midnight. Hancock. I mean, one of the great courses in all of America. But
have you
played
Riverside yet?
I have, and I'm a huge fan. I'm a big fan of Riverside. It's it's an old Maxwell. And I say that to my friends out there that, you know, hardly play any golf. And I'm like, hey, guys, like, I understand you don't care about this at all. But just FYI, like, this thing does have really cool bones to it. And, you know, if you kind of put the goggles on. Yeah. And like Harvey Penick's house is right behind the, I believe, the fourth green or something like that. But, you know, if you kind of put the goggles on and think about it through, OK, does this look a little bit like a Colonial or something like that? You can see it. It's just. It really does teach you some things about, well, you know, those mowing lines were probably not meant to be that way. You know, the bunkers weren't meant to be pulled 14 feet off the greens and all the greens are tiny little circles. But if you really think about it, you know, you can see the Maxwell in it. And when it's not just like a complete watery mess, it is a very cool place. I live like 10 minutes away from there.
Hopefully at some point they do something there. I mean, it's that Lions, it's got potential. I mean, obviously it's a growing metroplex, but having lived there for a summer in my formative years, it was really hard playing public golf. You just have to drive far. It's expensive and, you know, there's not a lot of great options. And but that being said, it is it's a wonderful city. I got back there. I've been back a couple times, but I was saying to somebody that I was having dinner with there, I was like, you know, when I lived there, I was like kind of mid to late 20s. I was single and I spent a summer there. I loved it. I don't quite understand why I left, you know, but you know, if I don't leave, then my life plays out completely different. I'm not talking to you right now and probably not, you know, doing what I'm doing now. So that's the funny thing about life. You're still too young to get to these moments of reflection that I've started to have now that I've started to enter my later 30s.
Aside from the other stuff that you mentioned, what I think about mostly when it comes to Austin is exactly some of the stuff that you did mention, which is public golf, the somewhat lack of accessibility, and particularly the difficulty that's placed upon you in terms of time, pace of play. We hear so much about pace of play these days with regard to the pro game, which is, it's valuable. And I think that that's certainly a starting point, but the way that that bleeds down into public play, into just recreational play, it's a much broader conversation because although pro golf is very important, there's a lot more to the game of golf than just pro golf. So we'll get there in a moment, but before we do, we got to hit the dirt. You were strong last time, Andy. So the people are excited. They want to hear it. What have you been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking lately?
Drinking wise, I've been trying to cut back on booze. You know, I got in like a habit of having like just a beer, you know, not nothing crazy. Like I have just one beer when I'm cooking dinner. Something about cooking really like is where the only time that I have like the urge to drink beer outside of a social setting is when I'm cooking. There's something about grilling food or cooking that a beer. So I've been trying to cut back. Lots of water lately. Lots of water. And then what I drink outside of water is coffee. So I'm in Central California, really what people describe as Northern California. I call it Central California.
It's just not. It's like 53% of the way up the state or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. Like we don't get to play this population game. We do it by dividing the state. But Equator Coffee is kind of my local roaster that delivers high quality beans that I'm looking for. So I've been doing the Equator Coffee, which is delightful. It's a delightful coffee roaster. I think they've got a pretty good national reputation. I think they're one of the, you know, they're well thought of roastery. But so that's why I've been drinking outside of water. Reading, I just got you know, a little while ago, the Mackenzie Reader. You know, Josh Pettit put together this. It's really just like a collection of all the writing that Alistair Mackenzie did, and then it also has some new essays and things. It's a really cool book. It's so beautiful. It's like something that you want to keep. I think that in the digital age of content, that's something that is missing a little bit. Sometimes you forget about is just how wonderful like a beautiful book is. It's really a great book. And what I love about it is that it's got like the famous Mackenzie things, right? The famous Mackenzie writings, but it's got some more obscure ones. Like there, he found articles like, you know, the last article he wrote is an article about water hazards, you know, and it was for, I think a Chicago publication. So, you know, it's got some obscure things, but then also I always love reading like Ben Crenshaw writing about Alistair Mackenzie. Mike DeVries wrote an article in it. And it's beautiful, beautiful graphics, beautiful sketches. It's an amazing book. It's an amazing presentation. Just really nailed it. And I think it's doing really well. He originally had planned to only do like 400. He's on his second or third, I think third production run of it. So it's $150. It's not cheap, but it is really beautiful. It's something that like, if you're into golf architecture, it's probably something you're going to keep for the rest of your life. So when you think about amortizing that, that book, across it, eating, I skipped eating. I went to reading.
It's all right. We often go way out of order with them. You just got to hit all four letters.
Eating. I've been on the road a bunch. So I guess eating wise, something that stood out. Okay, so something I've thought about a lot. I tweeted about this, and I'm curious. I'm not a fast food person. The town I live in here in California has no chain restaurants. The only chains we have a 7-Eleven, a Bank of America, and a UPS store just opened. So there's three chains in my entire town. So I do not eat a lot of chain, but I do eat it on the road occasionally. I try and eat local. But something that I've really formulated on is Shake Shack is by far the best national quick burger you can get. It's not even a contest. It's out of this world. I get the avocado one. It's got like avocado and bacon on it. It's incredible. I just do the single patty. That's all I need. It's out of this world. I don't think it gets enough respect. Obviously, it gets a lot of respect. It's grown like crazy. But man, Shake Shack, it's just on a different level than everybody else. It's not even close.
Yeah, I respect that take. I'm frankly not a huge burger guy, so I'm not like deeply passionate about this subject. But I mean, certainly know enough to say that I guess they are in a little bit of a different category. But you commonly hear the In-N-Out versus Shake Shack. And then, of course, Five Guys comes in there. Frankly, I find In-N-Out to be overrated. I think there's a lot
way
of novelty.
Overrated.
Some people go to California and they're like, oh my God. And it's also, I mean, look, we have In-N-Out in Austin, but people go somewhere and they haven't seen it before. And they're like, oh my God, I've heard it's amazing. And then you have it and it's good. It's not that special. You know, the only Smashburger, get that out of here. That's total trash. If anyone rides for Smashburger, like absolutely not. The only debate to me that really holds a bit of water is the Five Guys people. I can hear that one
Five Guys Legion is strong. They come out, they are ready to defend Five Guys' honor.
Yeah, no, I can kind of understand that one, but I like the Shake Shack take. I think there's something about it that, you know, Five Guys, it feels a little dirty going to Five Guys.
That's,
you know, the fries
agreed.
In the bag. Shake Shack to me, you kind of feel like a little bit more of an upstanding citizen. You're like, yeah, I'm having a burger, but like, I'm not doing anything too crazy. Five Guys is like, hey, I just walked 36. I just need to get some food in me. And so I'm going to go hard. And Five Guys is the option, you know. Shake Shack's a more sustainable business model.
That's the thing, is the Five Guys that I think there's just like one of the things I think I like, and people may take offense to this. People might say that this shouldn't even be a grading criteria here, but like the cleanliness of the Shake Shack, of the delivery mechanism, stuff's not shooting out all over your hands, all over everything. You don't feel like you like are just like inhaled some grease. Like there's just a nice cleanliness to the burger experience. Like, right. You can have like, and I'm not saying that messy burgers don't have merit. I'm all for a delicious, but there's something elegant about the Shake Shack delivery. Now, like this is of course like readily available burgers almost anywhere you go that I'm talking about. Now, if we want to talk about like best burgers, I'm going to ride for Small Cheval in Chicago, Au Cheval, Small Cheval. That is like the greatest $12 burger you can get in America. And I will go to bat for that. And it's an incredible, like the Small Cheval burger stand. It just makes you so sad about like what happened with McDonald's and how they just like eliminated so many small burger stands, and like that experience of like your local burger stand being like a place you just like walk up and get a burger, and it's like cheap and it's fast and everything. And that became what McDonald's became for every town, right? But Shake Shack is outstanding. I guess that's my takeaway.
I respect it. What's been on the dome? What have you been thinking about?
We talked about it a little before we started recording, but honestly, to be, and I'm sure this is true of anybody that runs a business, the business has just been on my mind a lot. That's generally between raising a child, keeping your wife happy, and then running a business. My mind is seemingly occupied a lot, but I think we're in this state of like we've grown a little bit in the last year, and it's just. You just always, I think one of the things with running a business that people, it's just, as you grow, you just have new problems come up. You solve problems, and then what arises is new problems. So, not problems. I mean, it's just new challenges, right? Problems is almost too sharp of a word, but, it's hard. Like you get pulled in different directions. And I think that's one of the things that we're trying to figure out is, I'm trying to figure out how my time's best used. And it's hard. It's challenging. Entrepreneurship is a very, very difficult thing. It's funny. People always ask me about the fried egg and starting it and everything. And I think like the number one thing that was so valuable to me was I was so naive to how challenging it is. We've gotten to some state of relevance, I guess, in the golf world, which, it's not a huge state of relevance. We're still small, scrappy and everything, but it just comes with a lot more different situations than you ever imagined that you'd encounter. Just keeping a growing team rowing in the same direction, focused. Like that's the number one thing I'm starting to, I've kind of realized is focus and expectations, of what you're doing. And then also just making sure that people have balance in their lives that work for you. I think that's the hardest thing is that with golf, it's so easy to it doesn't feel like you're working when you're working. And then you realize like, God, I just worked my ass off for a week and I kind of neglected the rest of my life. It's so easy to neglect, things when you love what you do, outside of, what you're doing. So I'm rambling here. I feel like this is a therapy session for me, that's been on my mind a lot lately.
Good stuff. The best dirts always turn into a bit of a therapy session, especially when we have fellow golf podcasters on. So it's good stuff. This is going to be maybe a therapy session, maybe more of a ranting session, especially since you're getting ready to go play and compete this afternoon. I don't want to put you in too bad a headspace around pace of play and all that it entails in the game. But that's probably where we're headed.
I'll always get myself in a bad headspace. I'm maybe the worst self-talker in all of golf, to be completely honest.
Wonderful. So first question, talking about competitive golf, speaking of the PGA Tour, let's just start with Andy. What's your take on, how that bleeds down into public golf, recreational golf? How do you articulate that importance? Because people talk so much about, Patrick Cantlay, and they call out these names of players that are just so slow. And, for me, honestly, I'm kind of like, do I wish it was faster? Absolutely. Do I think it'll get faster over time? I think they'll sort some things out, but ultimately, it is their job, and you can only really rush someone to do their job so quickly. So I think as it pertains solely to the bubble that is the PGA Tour, pace of play to me only is so interesting. But what I become much more interested in is what is it that those guys do on the TV that then bleeds into the rest of the game? What do you think is most important when it comes to recreational golf and its comparison between the PGA Tour with pace of play?
This is a challenging question. Obviously, I think one of the things that recreational golf encounters that pro golf doesn't is you have a lot of facilities that do foursomes every 7 minutes, 8 minutes. There's just substantially more players on the golf course, right? So that's the first challenge that you have to understand. There's difference, right? Obviously, I think professional golf and the way pros play has an outsized impact on the game of golf in general. You know, they are example setters. They are role models for the youth. I'm sure you saw this playing collegiate golf. Like, trends in pro golf are actually more relevant and more visible at the collegiate level and at the junior level. So, like, the things that I notice is, like, guys in college golf are longer than professional golfers. So that tells you that, like, the tour's only going to get longer. People that's true with junior golf. Junior golfers are longer than ever. And it also is true with pace of play. So anyways, I think, like, the big thing is, like, listen, like, recreational golf, there's different levels of pace of play problems at recreational golf too. Right, you have, like, your muni. I think, like, the pace of play situation is most evident at, like, your busy city muni, more so than anything. And then, like, I would say actually behind that is, like, your high-end resort on a waterfront, like Whistling Straits and Pebble Beach are notorious for, like, 5-6 hour rounds, right? And that's the same problem that's encountered at Rancho Park in Los Angeles. I think, like, you're at this age, right? And this is where it's, I have my most, like, pace of play horrors is, like, from my, like, early and mid 20s and late 20s, playing public golf in a city is where you encounter the biggest pace of play nightmares. And it frankly, it makes it really hard to play golf. It makes the sport a little bit less approachable, right? Like, I think that it gives golf really, you know, it's one of the things that I always think about is, like, how do we solve for golf? Like, a lot of people are always focused on the making golf easier. I think one of the things about golf is that makes it so appealing, that makes it such a popular sport among the people that love it, is how difficult it is. Like, it's unconquerable. And that's, like, an amazing quality. Those are, like, kind of the, there's a lot of traits in enduring games about the, you know, not being able to play a perfect game, or play the perfect game is so rare. Like, you know, I think, you know, no matter how well you play, you always walk off the course saying, oh, I could have done this or this or this. And that's what makes you want to keep coming back. But, like, the big problem to me is always going to be pace of play, right? Especially when you see the way the world's changing, right? Is, like, the attention span's getting shorter. We're in this wonderful, wonderful age of golf where, you know, I think work from home has been such a big thing for golf popularity. Like, you see weekday rounds are way up. I mean, like, through the roof up. And that's afforded golf, like, a wonderful thing. But going to a place like Rancho Park in Los Angeles, a place like Sidney Berovitz, the nine holer in Chicago on a weekday, on a weekend at 11 a.m., you're signing up for 3 hour nine hole rounds. In Rancho Park's case, a 6 hour 18 hole round. And listen, like, if you love golf, you deal with it. I remember when I lived in Los Angeles and I was there for work, you know, one of the great things with my office was Central Time. They'd be cutting out at 6 o'clock and it would be 4 o'clock on the West Coast. And I'd know nobody was back in the office. So, you know, I lived right by Rancho Park. I'd head over to Rancho Park. I'd get in the queue, get out there, and, like, you know, I'd play 6-7 holes before it was dark. It would take two and a half hours, but, you know, and I'd just be sitting on the ground between every shot, but it was still great, right? If you love golf, you deal with it, but it's less than ideal. Like, I think some of the rounds I remember most is when you're out on a course, and this is, you know, not really realistic for all rounds, but you're out on a course, there's nobody around, and you're racing against the sun to finish. And there's that pace of play, the pace element of, like, I'm in it, I'm getting to the next shot, I'm going through my things, but I'm also watching that clock, right? Which is the sun.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's funny you talk about doing the Pacific to Central time. I do the opposite. I'm Central to Pacific. A lot of people I work with are out on the West Coast. And so hence my 6:45 a.m. golf endeavors this morning. You know, it's something you mentioned there that I was thinking about before we hit record here, because it's so easy when you talk about something like pace of play to be like, yeah, the tour guys just have to speed up. Like, they just play too slowly. Let's just put the shot clock on them and make them play faster. And, you know, it's really just not that simple. Like, I don't want to start throwing haymakers at people that just don't deserve them. You know, we can't just tell tour players when they've got a putt to win the Masters or something like that, yeah, you got 30 seconds to hit the shot. I mean, I don't know.
Well, maybe, we can.
But we certainly can. But I think some of those things become somewhat unrealistic in certain ways. But, you know, one thing that does interest me is the degree to which we produce the product. And so while it is a very, very interesting part of it, and I think for particularly the later groups in a tournament, seeing the process that players go through is a pretty fascinating piece of it. I do think that we probably do ourselves a disservice in golf coverage to show too much of the non-golf shot side of things, because just as you put it, with junior golf being slow, college golf being slow, when we watch the guys on tour go through 9 different numbers and read a putt from 4 different angles and all of these different things, all of a sudden that becomes par for the course, essentially. People think that that's just how you play the game, whether it's competitive, whether it's recreational, whether you're professional, or whether you're a 35 handicap. And to me, that becomes a big issue with our pace of play. You know, I think about, you mentioned college golf. Every player, especially when there's a coach out there, they take like 2.5 minutes to hit a golf shot, because people think that the way that someone's going through their process on every single shot when they're coming down the stretch in a major is the way that competitive golf is played. And to me, I think that we do shoot ourselves in the foot a little bit to show too much of the process of competitive golf. But then again, as I put it, like, that is some of what can be most interesting. So the way that product is shown to me can become as big of a question as, you know, what is actually going on with the product, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the hard thing for presentation, right, producing golf, is you don't know when somebody's going to hit the ball, right? Like, I think that's the appealing thing about a shot clock. If you wanted to go down that road, is like, golf production would never be better, because you'd actually have like a context around when they're going to hit. And I think, like, I get like the indecision and the caddy conversations yield some really interesting things, and there are moments where you might not be ready to hit and everything, but like, isn't that kind of the compelling thing with like, with almost every sport? Isn't like, when, I mean, the best moments are typically when somebody's having to make a play while they're, you know, fighting against something. Like, it's when the defense in football calls an all out blitz on 3rd and 4, and you see like, what's the quarterback going to do? What's Tom Brady, you know, obviously retired, but like, is Tom Brady going to hit that slant across the middle like he always has and pick up the first down? If you take it to basketball, it's like, you know, there's 10 seconds left and it's the end of a quarter, end of a game, and they're down 1. Like, what are they going to do? Like, to me, that's, I think, like, while it's hard, any problem, and this goes throughout life, any problem in any situation, usually the right solution is a hard one. And I think, like, what you said about college golf, like, in a way, like, the thing is, like, everybody was, oh, shot clock's going to make it harder. I think for a lot of people, like, it actually might make it easier. You're going to react and get into a flow better. Like, when I think about my golf game, and I'm different than, like, I think that's the beautiful thing about golf, right? Is everybody plays different. Everybody plays better in different circumstances. Some players are better when everything slows down and they take their time. I personally am a better player when I get in a rhythm and I think less, like when I'm really operating on feel and get into that nice flow, right? So I think there's like a lot of players that would actually play better with a clock, right? Because it, when I think too much, I get doubt, and that's when I hit, make bad swings and hit poor putts, right? So I struggle with pace of play a lot because I think it's very avoidable at the professional level. And just like what we're seeing with the MLR ball and potential rollback is like, if you push from the professional level down, I think there's a real belief in the USGA that like there's going to be a trickle down effect to effectively anybody that has any interest in playing at a high level are going to play that ball, right? And I think the same thing would go with a shot clock. If there's just a shot clock on the PGA Tour and in major championships, I think that all of a sudden everybody that has any virtue of playing will be playing fast because they understand that this could be something they encounter at some point. And that trickles down through an entire club. People mimic the best players at clubs or best players at courses or best junior golfer in their area. Like I remember, I don't know if you ever experienced this, you're a different generation than me, but I remember like I went to the US Junior when I was like, it was at Conway Farms in 97. So I was 11 and I saw Aaron Baddeley. And Aaron Baddeley at that time was like the cat's meow, right? And I remember like looking at the clubs he was using, the shoes he was wearing and thinking, man, I want to be like him, right? Like, I think that this is the thing about, is it golf, the better players at every level have an outsized impact on the sport. And I think it's super important for things to be addressed at the, from the top down in the game.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So I was thinking a lot there about shot clock stuff, and I've heard other people talk about that. And so my take on it, coming from like a competitive mindset and then also thinking about it in practice, and also I love the analogies to other sports, like comparing it to football, comparing it to basketball. Personally, I think that the shot clock, obviously in basketball, is like completely necessary. You can't have guys just hold possession for a minute and a half on their side of the court and pass it around. Completely wouldn't work. But the other thing that I think about is that I find calling fouls more interesting than watching the shot clock. When there's 9 seconds left on the shot clock and they start hurrying up, like you kind of know what's going on. But personally, I don't find that as interesting as when a guy makes a drive down low, like are they going to blow the whistle or are they not? Also, on top of that, I think that the subjectivity of calling fouls has applicability from the standpoint that we all know that at the end of the game, if you make a drive down low, I mean, you better get tackled if they're going to call a foul. And so the way that I then put that into golf is, so if we took this more as like each group were to have a walking, they already have walking scores, but if they were to have a walking pace of play monitor, and it's very well communicated to guys, look, we are going to try to speed this game up, and this is what's expected. And here's a rough time that it should take, but we're not saying that if it takes 42 seconds, now all of a sudden that's a penalty because circumstances come up. Like if someone's nice and quick, if they get up to their ball, they're ready to hit, and then a big wind gust comes through and they decide to change clubs. Like to me, that's not really a pace of play violation. That's simply playing the game. That's part of the art of it. And I don't think you should be penalized for that. You shouldn't have to say, I know I have the wrong club in my hand, but I'm going to hit it anyway because I'm going to get a pace of play violation. Also, like if you're at the end of a tournament and you've got a really important putt to win, you know, that's kind of comparing it to that foul situation. Like no one calls fouls at the end of games. You shouldn't be called for a pace of play violation necessarily at the very end of a tournament. But if you are someone, and you know, we'll just use him again as an example, and I think he's become the punching bag. It's obviously no hot take because he's always on TV, but you know, we'll punch the punching bag, Patrick Cantlay. If you're walking slow, you're taking a lot of time around shots, you're doing basically everything it takes to slow down golf, like you should be violated for that. And there are other players like a Jordan Spieth, for example, that he's talked about this very openly, that he likes to take time around the ball, but he'll walk as quickly as he can from shot to shot so that he allows himself more of that time. That again goes back to, if we just do it purely on a shot clock basis, and once he gets to his ball, he has 40 seconds, he might be getting penalties galore, but he doesn't get any merit for walking more quickly to his ball. But anyway, point being that to me, I think that it's a subjective matter, and particularly as it pertains to competitive golf, because there are just times when things take more time, when you actually care out there. And there's, you know it, like when you're in a group and someone's slower, you very, very, very well know, is this guy trying to play any quicker or is he not trying to play any quicker? And it just makes everybody that much more frustrated. So I don't know if that's really a solve, but I think that it's worth discussing.
The brutal thing about it is, like, if you are a fast player, you are penalized.
Exactly.
By slow players. And I think that that's the root of the issue here, right? And I think that's where it's really dangerous. And you know, and I guess this is good. I mean, a little bit of a point counterpoint here is like why you can't make it subjective. It needs to be objective. And let's just say you gave everybody a minute to hit a shot. You know, the other ball lands, it comes to a rest, and your clock starts, and you have a minute. You know, I think it could be 40 seconds. It could be, you know, it could be 35. But if you say you have a minute, a smart player is going to have all their work done in 30 seconds. So in case a wind gust comes up, they have time to reset, grab a new club, go through their routine, and hit the shot. I think you can add an element of timeouts. But if you leave it to subjectiveness, we're not going to move anywhere from where we are. And, you know, I mean, it was crazy. I was at a course a couple of weeks ago, and I was just waiting to drive somewhere, and I was waiting for a guy to tee off. He took like 3 minutes to tee off, and just like, it was insane because I was sitting there, I was kind of running late, and I'm just waiting for this guy to tee off. And I was like, this is nuts that this is his routine. I couldn't, and they were on the first tee. I was thinking to myself, I couldn't imagine being the playing partner in this group. It was a twosome and just watching this every single hole. And I think that's the hard thing about it is that in a way, slow players are the ones that are given the pass and they actually hinder the fast players. We've seen it obviously with Brooks Koepka and major championships. Like you can tell there's a lot of frustration on his face about pace of play. There are a ton of slow players on the PGA Tour. I think it's been, you know, like, is Patrick Cantlay slow? Yes, he's absolutely a slow player. There are so many of them on tour. Totally. At the Masters, when he was getting all the flack, they were waiting. I mean, that's the thing. They were waiting. Russell Henley, I mean, like, it's something that I think is, like, absolutely ludicrous is, like, you know, the 50-yard pitch shot where players walk all the way up to the green and inspect the green and walk back. That's a slow play violation. You know, it takes 2+ minutes to hit the shot. And like, guess what? If you hit it to 50 yards, maybe you shouldn't be able to go up and read and inspect the green.
What if it's on the third at Augusta? Should you even hit it to 50 yards or should you lay it back? I don't know. That's the thing.
If you lay it back, then all of a sudden, maybe that's an advantage. Maybe that's one of the, it dissuades. It would, you know, I think like one of the fascinating aspects of this is if you instituted a shot clock, how would the game change? You know? And I think like, I don't think it would change for the worse, but I think there'd be some strategic changes. Like the, all of a sudden places like blind shots might be a little bit more something you think about, like, do I really want to hit it where I'm kind of semi-obscured? Because like that's going to be an uncomfortable shot and I'm going to have to trust a number. I'm not going to be able to walk up there, but like you shouldn't be able to just walk up and inspect a green. That'd be like Tom Brady getting to pause the, you know, and I use Tom Brady, he's retired now, so let's just use Patrick Mahomes. Like, all right, we're going to pause the play clock. Let me walk over into the defense and see exactly where the linebackers and the safeties are. And then come back and snap the ball. Like, nobody move. We're going to go up there and inspect all the little intricacies. Like, there needs to be that relationship. I mean, it's written in the rules of golf that it's, I think it's 40 seconds is the is the, you know, suggested time to play a shot?
When a group gets put on the clock, 40 is the number. Yeah.
I don't get why that's not just a regular standard. And these guys are so good. They build it all into their routine. It's not a huge, and I think like the idea of making changes like this, like these guys are professionals. That's what happens. It's almost every industry in the world is regulated, right? Like there are things that change like in, you know, business that you have to just change the way you do processes. When you hire new people, you change the processes and you do different jobs. Like this is not the end of the world. And I think like you can't talk. And I know we wanted to talk about pace of play at public golf courses. You can't talk about that without talking about the professional game where people watch TV and get the idea of like, this is how long it should take.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And I, you know, I love the back and forth we have going here. I will push back slightly on the objectivity and, you know, your example of walking up to the green. You know, you see that all the time, but so like a Jordan Spieth, I think so he's an example of a player to me that is he the fastest guy out there? No, but he's conscious. And to me, that's what it is it's like, are you conscious of the pace of your play or are you not? And guys that are a little bit slower, if they know that and they're taking acts to basically speed themselves up around the shot or between shots, whatever it may be, that to me is completely fine. And so that's a guy, if he wants to walk up and see the green on a 50 or 60 yard shot, he's going to do it while the group ahead of him is still putting out. Whereas other guys, they'll wait until the pin is put in and then they walk all the way up there. And you're just like, what are you doing, man? Like you literally just wasted 3 minutes while you stood there, waited for the pin to be put in. And so that to me goes back to kind of the subjective nature of it is, if we had walking scores out there, monitoring guys, talking as, you know, officials do on a football field, when they say, you know, they go confer about, hey, what's going on here, there. If those guys were talking, you know, not directly, but over the air and saying, hey, who's really slowing down the golf course here? Because I like your example there at the Masters of Patrick Cantlay got so much flack for his pace of play. Well, if he's waiting, like at the end of the day, you can only speed things up if you can speed things up. You know, if you're going to wait on every single shot, even if you're taking a little bit too long, you're not going to move the needle at all. And so to me, that becomes the question is like, who are the anchors to the pace of play on the course? Like who is really slowing it down? And if the answer is fairly objective for players, then to me, that's where you should institute penalties. But I do agree that there does have to be something objective to it. Like if a guy starts to get too many bad times or whatever it is, yes, I think that it's the blend of the two that becomes most important.
I think that the reality about like who's slowing down the course, it just takes one person. And maybe, you know, and this could be probably more agreeable is like, maybe you get a set an allotted amount of time. Like you have to average out at 1 minute per shot. Some guys take more time around the greens. Like I did this timing exercise when Bryson was really being accused of slow play. You know, it was at the US Open at Pebble Beach. I went out and timed everybody in his group for every shot for 9 holes. And like it shed light because he was like, I'm not a slow player. And it was like, well, actually you are, right? And the group was Kisner, JT, and Bryson. And Bryson was really slow on all shots. But there are different degrees of slow, right? He was particularly slow when he was the first guy to hit an approach shot, which he doesn't do that often because of how long he is. But he was really slow there. He was extremely slow on putts. He was a little bit faster off the tee, but you saw the same types of trends. Like Kevin Kisner, if he was second to hit on a hole, would hit his approach shot in 12 seconds. Now, the thing where everybody was universally slow was on the green. Everybody was averaging over a minute a shot on the green. So to me, that is kind of where the slow play happens. It's at and around the greens. JT, I think he took over 3 minutes to hit a shot, a 20-yard pitch. Again, It was him going up and inspecting the green, right? Like, that's where it gets slowed down. And maybe you have like an allotted time because you're going to be in circumstances where you play fast and maybe you get seconds back when you do that, but your average needs to be below 40 seconds. Otherwise you're penalized. If you penalize these guys' shots, everybody's going to fall in line. That's the thing that I think that is most frustrating about slow play is it, if it was just enforced, if pace of play penalties happened, everybody would play fast, but they don't. Yeah. There's been two pace of play penalties in like the last 15 years. And they pop guys that have no relevance. I think on tour, they popped Brian Campbell and somebody else at the Zurich, two guys with like conditional status on tour. They popped Hideki at Muirfield. They popped the amateur at the USA, at the Masters, the 14-year-old amateur. Yeah.
Tian Lingguan, yeah. I remember that.
Exactly.
Almost missed the cut for that reason.
Yeah, and Hideki was in the mix at Muirfield. Johnson Wagner was playing with him and went like nuts. And Johnson Wagner is known for being like extremely stoic and polite. But like they pop guys that, you know, it was 18-year-old Hideki Matsuyama. You know, they pop people that don't have relevance. The problem is they don't pop somebody like Cantlay or JT or Bryson. They're afraid. And I don't know. I don't foresee, and I hate for this to be super pessimistic, but until the pace play is addressed at the professional level, nothing's going to happen at the public level.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's why it's important to have that piece of the conversation. Pivoting into the public side, this is one of the main things I wanted to throw at you today. So I've had this concept, and it might be an absolutely terrible idea, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it. I think one of the biggest issues of in public golf, in recreational golf, but just simply in golf at large with pace of play is the fact that not only is it not completely enforced, but because it's not enforced, it's just not really kosher within golf being a more gentlemanly sport to basically say to a group like, hey, you guys are too slow. And it becomes a completely different conversation if it's just a slow day. But when you do have that one slow group who's a hole and a half behind, you're just kind of being a little bit of a jerk. It doesn't mean that you can't do it, but it's not really par for the course for people to go out and say, hey, you guys are being too slow. I think it would be fascinating to implement and in terms of pricing, we could get into a whole conversation around that as well, whether it's more expensive, less expensive. But if we implemented tee times at certain parts of the day where it says, hey, look, between 2 p.m. and 4 p.m., these are 4-hour round blocks. And if you're not able to play quickly enough, and obviously you'd have to sort it out with the rest of the course, but let's pretend you can make it work. And for a block of tee times, you say, look, if you're going to tee off in this block, if you're playing 450, someone absolutely has the right to come chew you out for it and just start there and say, we're going to do it as a test and see if it's possible and give people the right to say, hey, look, the expectation is that you play quickly here. What do you think? Is there any chance that that works from a public standpoint?
I do. I think the thing that needs to happen, and this is a hard role, is like you got to have somebody out there marshaling. It's not a fun conversation to have. And like, I mean, what are
exactly?
You,
and that's the point, is that like it gives the marshal the right to say, like, look, guys, 4-hour blocks. You guys just played the front nine in 235. Not working.
I mean, I wonder if there's a way you could like gamify it, right? I mean, like, could it be where you get money back if you play sub 4 hours? Like, your expectations to play 4 hours. We have your credit card. And if you play under, like, we give you the percentage under 4 hours you played back, right? Is that a way you could do it? You really incentivize people to play quicker. The one other issue I foresee is just like, I don't know if you want to create conflict between groups on the course. Like, you know, you could have somebody that really wants to save some money getting frustrated and hitting into the group in front of them that might be just playing at 4-hour pace, right? That would be, I guess, like thinking through it in my head, the downside of that. But I think like what you have to do, and this is hard because it's like, who is a marshal, right? It's usually like a guy that's retired that is, you know, doing it as an hourly job to get free golf. Like, is he really incentivized and empowered to go out there and push pace of play?
I think that the way I would bring that back around is I like your incentive. So incentive for the marshal, but also for groups. And where I kind of bring that into context is like, in what public setting other than golf, really, are you not essentially charged for your time? You know, like, are there 3-hour restaurant experiences? Yes, but it pretty
They're
much
trying
doesn't
to move
happen.
You along. Yeah.
Right. Like if you're going to sit in a restaurant for 3 hours, for everyone that I know of, you're paying for that. You know, it's an expensive restaurant. And if it's a $25 meal, which is not that expensive these days, like if you sit there for more than about 50 minutes or so, they move you along. And the waiter is very much incentivized to move you along because they want another table to sit down so they can get another tip. And obviously the restaurant is incentivized for those people to move along so they can get another group in there to buy food. And so I think that if you somehow bring those things into conversation, obviously the golf course is incentivized to get more people out there. But if you say to the marshal, like, hey, look, we're trying to get more people through. And if people are going to be getting money back, like there is an interesting piece of that, that a marshal isn't just purely paid like an hourly wage and that he does get some portion of that money that could be made from having more groups out there. But yes, that's a very integral part to the conversation that like it has to be marshaled by somebody and there does have to be incentive for them to actually get people around.
I think incentivizing the marshal makes a lot of sense, right? I like the restaurant analogy, right? Because like tables are effectively tea times. And the more tea times, like the faster the pace of play at a golf course, the less, you know, the shorter the twilight window becomes, if that makes sense. Because okay. Twilight rates really are like, you know, you may or may not get this round in. Or super twilight, whatever you want it to be. And if that window extends out and you can charge more money for a longer period of time, the golf course makes more money. The faster the pace of play is, the more players they get in and out. It's an interesting idea is if you're an operator of the golf course, you incentivize your staff around pace of play. Because like, honestly, I think you could charge more money if you have consistently great pace of play.
Absolutely.
That is like an absolute part of your product. Like you have course conditions, you have the course design, you have the practice facilities, which enable you to charge a certain amount for balls and other things. You have your location is a big part of like what your offering is as a golf course. Pace of play should be thought of in the same vein as that, right?
Yeah,
because it's absolutely it's the way somebody experiences your course. Just like if you have like, I mean, this is just a kind of an innocuous comparison here, but like if you have like the rickety table at a restaurant, it like negatively impacts your experience. Like you don't want to have rickety tables at restaurants because like if they slant and something spills, people get pissed off. It impacts their experience. Or you have slow service at a restaurant. It impacts your experience. Like pace of play should be thought of that way at golf courses.
Absolutely. And this is like operations modeling stuff 101. That if you have at a restaurant, everything works well for a restaurant analogy. So yeah. Let's just keep rolling with it. Like the busier times, I'm not using Chipotle. I've been so anti Chipotle. So I'm not using that example, but Cava. So we'll use Cava, which is not my favorite either, but Cava is better than Chipotle. That's for sure. If you're at Cava and you're a worker there, there is a big difference in what you're going to be paid if you're working the 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. shift versus the 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. shift. You know that those are peak hours. You're going to be cranking people through. It's higher pressure. It's a tougher job. And people are going to be compensated that way. I think that at a golf course, it would be very interesting to say, okay, the marshals that are going to marshal for the faster tee times we're going to pay them more. It's a harder job, but you're going to be paid for it. And then to me, what that could do over time is potentially say, okay, well, not only are you being paid more for that, but the reason you're being paid for is because we're charging more for those tee times, because I know I would certainly pay 20%, whatever it is, more to know that I can get a certain number of holes in. I mean, look, literally, you're saying to somebody like, hey, we'll charge you $50 to maybe get in 12 holes, or we'll charge you $80 to know that you can get in 18. I mean, you're literally being paid back for it on a hole basis right there. But to me, over time, then you start to say, okay, well, if this is working, then it's just flat out working. And so the marshal job, is it a little bit harder? Yes, but we can pay people for it. And the course is making more money because you're getting A, more golfers through, and B, you're getting more money for it. So, you know, everything sounds great when you just talk about it like this. And that's probably all this is just two guys having a conversation. But
maybe,
look, I think it's a conversation
worth
having.
Maybe the marshal should be elevated to the level of superintendent and head golf pro. Like, it should be, you know, marshal is right there.
Well, yeah, it's like PGA Tour events. You have elevated marshals. You know, you've got elevated events, you've got standard events, you've got the marshals that are elevated.
Ugh. I think, like, one of the things that you see, so I think this conversation is very like public daily fee driven, right? Now, on the counter, I've heard this a lot from like Whistling Straits and Pebble Beach, these iconic resort courses, is like, I'm paying $500, I'm paying $800, whatever, you know, these places are charging dollars. I want to soak in every moment that I can of it. So I'm okay playing for 6 hours.
And to some degree, I think where that goes is kind of the analogy I made to, like, hey, look, you go to a Michelin star restaurant, there are some that do, but by and large, you don't get whipped through there in 45 minutes. You are paying for your time to sit down and have a 2.5 or 3 hour meal. But for some reason in golf, that becomes a little bit of a lost conversation, that you're kind of on the clock and you're paying for the time at that place. And so I would generally agree with that sentiment that, look, if you're going to Pebble Beach and you're going to pay $700 for it, like, yeah, part of what you're paying for is to take that 4 minute photo and to take extra time on the 7th tee box. And, you know, you see it at the 17th at Sawgrass, like, people pay $500 to kind of play one hole to some degree and take the picture and do the whole deal. But where we started, like, you were paying for that. Whereas at lesser public courses, it's not as transactional from a standpoint of, I am paying to spend time out here all day as much as I want. It's cheap. You want to get it as cheap as possible, and you want to get in as much golf as possible. I think that it's a good call out that there's a big difference in what we're talking about between, like, the local muni, like, dollars per hole, because to some degree, that's how I think about it these days. Like, how much do I have to pay per hole, essentially, versus like the experience? And I think that it does, you know, it works for restaurants to say, like, look, really nice places, you pay for that big, long experience and you get to stay kind of as long as you want. But if you're not flat paying for it, I think that's where we can get a little bit more ticky-tacky around, like, how can we speed this thing up and make it a better experience?
I think the tricky thing about that, though, is, like, if you're slow, you negatively impact everybody else's experience, right? So while some people might want to be out there for 6 hours, others might be like, I have spouse and kids that I need to get back to. And that every minute I'm out here, I'm not with them. Right. I think that, you know, golf is, this is perspective that I think you gain as you get a little bit older, as you have a family, if you have a family, golf can be like a very selfish endeavor, right? And that time away takes time away from other things. And I think that's like the big thing, is like, it's a lot of it's just being conscientious. And I wonder a lot about just if it's just American culture, because this isn't a problem in Scotland. I mean, Scotland, you're talking about playing 3 hours. Australia is extremely quick with their golf. And I think like part of it might just be an American thing, where you just have kind of this, you know, it's people are a little bit more selfish. People are a little bit more about like, I paid this, it's my right to do this. And there is that just general sentiment versus like, hey, this is a community thing. This is like a, it's a kind of like a tragedy of the commons type situation, right? Where yes. Everybody, what everybody else does out there impacts everybody else. And I don't think people think about that enough. Playing quick golf is being respectful to the other people on the golf course. That's like, without a doubt, a true statement. And in any situation, whether it's a private club, high-end resort, $5, $10 muni, a pitch and putt, that should be considered by everybody is what I do impacts everybody else.
Yeah, I think we just kind of found our ending point there because that's like every time I sit here and think about pace of play, I think exactly what you just said, which is that it is a cultural thing that happens to be, in my opinion, kind of on the negative side in America. You know, I know that you've done stuff with the Cookie Jar guys before, and you know, we've had some podcasts with them, and they're really interesting. And so we were having a conversation somewhat similar to this at some point, and it was around, you know, how do we put together a trip, a sort of a budget golf trip that is by and large public golf, either in the UK or in the States. And it's just like, it's such a hard conversation to have because they're like, oh yeah, like we can throw together like 8 great courses for you that are within an hour of each other. And they're all like £60. And we're like, yeah, I mean, if you want to play any sort of good golf in the States, like $60 doesn't get you anywhere, you know? And so it's so interesting to me that not only is it cheaper over there, but it's way faster as well. And so it is just, it's such an American specific thing, I believe. That and maybe it would be true of other certain countries, but a lot of the ones that you mentioned, Scotland, England, Australia, it's cheaper, it's faster, it's just a different mindset. Golf isn't.
Maybe it's cheaper because it's faster and more people can play.
Yeah, exactly. I think that and kind of where I began with, it's just a cultural thing, it's a mindset thing, and you know, let's take it all the way back to the beginning. I think if we can start to solve the problem a little bit more through the professional game. And make pace of play something that people are focused a little bit more on. It would be very interesting to see how that makes its way down to the rest of the game. And, you know, whether it's the money behind it or just simply the pace of play of the game and how people treat each other out there. If we start to solve some of these issues by, you know, getting the Patrick Cantleys of the world to, you know, hurry it up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you having me on. It's a huge problem, and I don't know what really. I think there's a lot of ways you could address it, but you know, I think everybody is so avert to or just against change that that is just such a tough one.
Hey, that's what guys like us do. Podcasters talk about the problems in the world that we can't solve, so it gives us something to talk about if nothing else.
Yeah. I appreciate you having me on, Henry.
Thanks, Andy. Cheers.